Number 10, The Reminder of the Evidence, in the series Conversations About God by Graham Maxwell, recorded March 30, 1984.
Welcome to the 10th of our Conversations About God. Another look at our Heavenly Father in the larger setting of the great controversy over his character and government. And the subject for our conversation this evening is the reminder of the evidence. And the title was chosen to suggest the important meaning and purpose of yet another of God's provisions to help us during this crisis of distrust. Unfortunately, the Sabbath has not always been understood as designed to help us in this way. On the contrary, it has been widely misunderstood, and misunderstood in such a way as to support Satan's charges against our God of being arbitrary, exacting, and severe. Even among devout observers of the seventh day, the Sabbath has often been so misunderstood, to our great loss, as on that very sad Friday 1900 years ago. But if we put the Sabbath in the setting of all 66 books and in the larger setting of the great controversy over the character and government of God, I believe that all arbitrariness evaporates. Now, the best known biblical verse and statement about the Sabbath, I suppose, is Exodus 20, right in the middle of the Ten Commandments, the first verse on our Bible reference sheet this week. Exodus 20, 8 and 11. Actually, the commandment runs all the way from 8 to 11. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. It's significant to note that in the New Testament, James calls the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, the royal law of liberty. Not the royal law of subjugation and surrender and bondage, but the royal law of freedom. And yet, when you read that commandment, at first, it could be understood as somewhat arbitrary, couldn't it? Is it possible that here we have one instance of God laying upon his children an arbitrary requirement just to show his authority and test their willingness to obey? But is not the message of all 66 books and certainly of these conversations about God that there is no arbitrariness in our God? And what a price he has paid to deny it. As Paul explains, and we'll discuss this on a later evening, under the title God's Law is No Threat to Our Freedom and God's Emergency Measures, God's laws were given not to be a burden and to restrict us. They were given to help us, to protect us in the days of our ignorance and immaturity, and lead us back to trust and on to freedom. And God values nothing higher than our freedom. And when you go all through the 66 and you come to the last one, the book of Revelation, you note that God is still asking us to remember him especially as our creator. You remember in Revelation 14, the three messages of the three angels. And the first angel says, as recorded on our Bible reference sheet, Revelation 14, 7, honor God, not fear God, remember last week, honor God and give him glory, for his time has come to sit in judgment. Worship the creator of heaven and earth, the creator of the sea and the springs. I hope you're able to recognize these versions. That's the New American Bible, a Roman Catholic translation of very great quality and a fine translation of the verse. Now, when we read that first angel's message, to worship the creator of heaven and earth, the creator of the sea and springs, naturally, we're reminded that the first mention of the Sabbath comes in the Bible at the end of creation week. I wondered if tonight we could think back in imagination to the very dramatic events of that first week of human history. The war had begun already up in heaven. Satan had already leveled his charges and accusations, and one third of the angels had already agreed with him that God is not worthy of our worship and our trust. And right in the middle of that devastating crisis, God invites his family to watch him as he creates yet another world, this time ours. How easily he could have created our world with a snap of his fingers in just an instant of time. But in the dramatic and significant setting of the great controversy, he chose this time to do it in 6 24-hour days. On the first day, all he said was, "Let there be light," that's all. And then day 2, 3, 4, 5, as God in unhurried majesty and drama unfolded his plans for our earth. By the 6th day, what a beautiful place this was. Where now were Satan's charges? That God was selfish. I mean, look at the freedom. He created us in his own image with power to think and to do. And we know from human history that he created us free to either love and trust him or hate him and spit in his face, because it has been done. And he created us able to do it. God even allowed Satan to approach our first parents at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he didn't hide that tree in some dark corner of the garden. He put it right in the middle, near the tree of life, so that Adam and Eve would see it every time they came to that other tree. Look in Genesis 2:9 on the reference sheet. In the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Of course, the God we know could be trusted not to allow our first inexperienced parents to be tested more than they were able to resist. You know he would do that. And so Satan was only allowed to approach them at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Adam and Eve were warned not to risk a confrontation with their wily foe. Isn't that the meaning of that famous key text next on the list in 1 Corinthians 10:13? But God keeps his promise, or God can be trusted, and he will not allow you to be tested beyond your power to remain firm. You see, that tree was not put there as a test of obedience, an arbitrary test of obedience. That tree was put there to help them, to protect them. You see, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was not placed there before sin, but after sin. If it was before sin, it was an arbitrary test. After sin, it was to help them and protect them like every other one of God's gracious laws. And then God stunned the universe by sharing with us, as far as he possibly could with mere created human beings, some of his own marvelous creative power. And God so designed it that when a man and a woman come together in love, they are able to share life with little people, create little people in their own image. And isn't it interesting to watch our children and our grandchildren? They look so much like us. They behave like us at our best points and our worst points. Truly, they do reflect our image, and God designed it to be this way. You recall God's words there in Genesis 1:28. Have many children. I wonder what he'd say to us now. Have many children so that your descendants will live all over the earth and bring it under their control. That was his original plan. And the Song of Solomon, right in the middle of the Bible, reminds us that this whole thing was God's idea. That we should be male and female, and feel the way we do about each other, and say the things we do to each other. and come together in love and create little people in our own image. He thought that all up himself. You know, he could have created us to look like E.T. or little green people with antennae from Mars. Just think what he might have done. And babies could have come in test tubes or these other ways that are being devised. No, not the way God designed it. Worries some people. Other people say, what kind of a God must he be to think it up this way? And then put a whole book in the Bible in the middle that worries some people and delights others. Think what the Song of Solomon says about our God, reminding us of that creation week and of the Sabbath that came at the end. Well, the universe watched all this. The universe that had heard the charges against God, they watched all this. And when it was over, they said, that's very good. Love and admiration for God must have known no bounds. Where now were Satan's charges that God does not respect the freedom of his creatures, or that he's very selfish in his use of authority and power? And so we have that next verse, Genesis 2, 2 and 3. On the sixth day, God completed or finished all the work he had been doing, and on the seventh day, he ceased. Rested does not mean he was tired. It's like an attorney saying, I've presented all my case and my evidence. I now rest my case. He ceased from all his work. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on that day he ceased from all the work he had set himself to do. Can you imagine how the universe spent the next 24 hours? As they celebrated with God, the first seventh day Sabbath. Now, it was not man's seventh day. It was our second day. And if the Sabbath were designed to give us a rest every seventh day since our creation, we should be observing Thursday. The first Sabbath was God's day of celebration, and the universe joined with him, and we were merely visitors. In fact, a little time had to pass before we discovered all that had gone on that week, though the whole universe had watched and now was celebrating with God how good it was. And God called on his family throughout the universe to join with him in reflecting on the significance of what had been done, the answers that had been given to Satan's charges, the falsity of his accusations, and the truth about freedom and love and generosity on the part of our gracious Heavenly Father. You see, the Sabbath was given after sin, not before. If it were given before, we might think of it as, again, an arbitrary test of our obedience. It was given after sin because we needed it very much. And it must have seemed to the universe looking on that the great controversy had been won by Friday night. But Satan's most serious charge against our God had not been dealt with. No event of creation week had dealt with his most serious charge that God had lied to his children when he warned that the consequence of sin is death. Nothing during creation week, eloquent as it was, dealt with that most serious charge. God waited thousands of years to answer that question. Finally, in the fullness of time, God sacrificed himself in the Son to demonstrate the truthfulness of his word. As we considered two Friday evenings ago, he did not ask us to prove the truthfulness of his word. He could have by leaving us to die. He came himself and died that awful death. And Jesus knew why he was dying. He put it all in the larger view of the great controversy. He knew about Satan's charges. And so as he died, he said, "It is finished." Just as God at the end of creation week said, "I've finished the work for this week." But when Jesus died on the cross, he said, "We finished it all." For the most important answer to the most devastating accusation had been given at such infinite cost. Look at John 19:30 on the list. It is finished. It is finished. What was finished? Well, look at John 17:4 next door. I have finished the work which you have given me to do. And his work was to reveal the character of God to angels and to men. On Friday evening, when Jesus died, at the end of creation week, all the major questions in the great controversy had been answered, and all of Satan's charges against God had been met. And how significant that the next day was the seventh day Sabbath. Jesus could have gone to heaven on Friday to hear the universe tell him, it's more than enough, everything is clear. Instead, he waited over the Sabbath hours. And can you imagine what the universe was doing? Surely the whole universe paused to reflect on the significance of what they had seen. And they joined with the Father in celebrating the costly victory that had been won and in thanking him for the costly evidence that had been presented. For now they knew the universe was secure for eternity. Now, as I understand it, this is the Sabbath God asked us to remember. We need to pause and be reminded of those truths in which the angels rejoice. This is certainly no mere test of our obedience. Caught up in the great controversy as we are, we need the message of the seventh day. Surely that's what Jesus meant when he said, the Sabbath was made for us. We weren't made for the Sabbath. Look at the next verse in Mark 2:27. The Sabbath was made for the good of man, as were all of God's laws. But then as you read on through the 66, as you know, the meaning of the Sabbath is repeated and enlarged. For example, on Sinai, in the Ten Commandments, the Sabbath is connected with creation. But then when you read on, John and Paul make it plain that the one who created us was none other than Jesus Christ. Look at the verses, John 1:3, and you know the whole setting for this. Through him, that is Jesus, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. Or put with that, Paul's comment in Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. Now think of the significance of that. The one who came to save us is the one who made us in the beginning. And who would know better how to heal the damage done? The gentle Jesus who walked so softly among men and then died the way he did on Calvary is not some weak person. He is the supreme, all-powerful creator of the whole vast universe. That's the one who died on Calvary. Nor did God send some subordinate person, not even the first of his angels. The Creator came. Himself, the one who is equal with God, for he actually is God. Then for some, every time we observe the seventh day Sabbath, we are publicly acknowledging to God, to our friends, and to ourselves that we have faith in Jesus as our Savior, as our Creator, and our God, no less. So then when you raise the question, what kind of a person is our God? Could the Father possibly be as gracious as the Son? The reply comes every Sabbath. God is just as gracious as the Son. For Christ, the one we call the Son, is God. Or does anyone think that he's less than that? If Christ is Creator God, then you want to know what our God is like? Just look at Christ And every Sabbath is to remind us of theology, that consequential. But then there are other ways in which the Sabbath helps strengthen our faith, mentioned in Ezekiel and in Exodus. Notice first Exodus 31:13 and observe that it's God speaking. Keep the Sabbath my day of rest, because it is a sign between you and me for all time to come, to show that I, the Lord, have made you my own people. And moving on to Ezekiel 20:20, make the Sabbath a holy day, so that it will be a sign of the covenant we made, and will remind you that I am the Lord your God. And the third one, Ezekiel 20, verse 12. I made the keeping of the Sabbath a sign of the agreement between us, to remind them that I, the Lord, make them holy. Note, the Sabbath is a reminder of very important truth about our God and his relationship with his people. His people, an unholy, sinful bunch. And yet God is saying to them, I've not abandoned you. I'm still working to save and heal you. I still regard you as my people. And notice that salvation is not merely forgiveness, but also healing of the damage done, making us holy people. Now, some of us keep the seventh-day Sabbath to show that only the Creator can heal the damage done. Only the one who made us in the beginning could restore us to what we used to be. He has the creative power, and it requires creative power. Surely it's no less a miracle to take damaged merchandise and restore it than to create perfectly in the beginning. And that's why when David prayed in Psalm 51:10, he said, create in me a clean heart, O God. The very same creative power is necessary to make us trustworthy, holy children of God one more time. Now, we cannot do this by ourselves. Some try by self-discipline and restraint and so forth. Surely we've realized that will not work. Only by faith and trust in our Creator can all the damage be perfectly restored. But then there are other ways in the Bible. When Moses repeated the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy, he gave a different reason than he gave in Exodus for keeping the Sabbath. Do you notice in Deuteronomy 5:15? Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. For that reason, that is the Exodus, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Now, that's no contradiction nor lapse of memory on the part of the elderly leader. The Sabbath is about God. He created us free in the beginning. And when we lost our freedom, he used his creative power to set us free again. Note, the Sabbath is always connected with freedom. Then there's another way, mentioned in Hebrews 4. And if you recall the whole chapter, the Sabbath there is described as a type and a foretaste of the rest to come. And if you can remember the argument, the apostle says that when Israel entered Canaan, they physically entered the promised land, but they certainly didn't enter God's rest because they didn't trust him. There remains, therefore, a Sabbath-like rest to the people of God. And that is, if we have been led and won to really trust God, we begin to enter into that Sabbath-like rest now. But certainly in the earth made new, we'll know what that Sabbath-like rest is all about completely. And so, look at Hebrews 4:9. So there must still be a promised Sabbath of rest for God's people. Goodspeed's translation. But look at the one in the Jerusalem Bible. There must still be, therefore, a place of rest reserved for God's people, the seventh-day rest. Isn't that an interesting rendering in that great Roman Catholic translation, the Jerusalem Bible? You see, the Sabbath all through the years has answered the basic questions of thoughtful people through the years. Where have we come from? Why are we here? Where do we go in the future? And above all, What kind of a person is our God? And what does he want of his children? The Sabbath has always answered those four questions. Where have we come from? Creation in the beginning. And all that happened then. Why are we here? How do we attain to the greatest good in life? Our whole purpose is restoration of the damage done by faith in God, being his holy, trusting people, and all the good things that will come to those who trust God. And where do we go in the future? The Sabbath has always pointed forward to the second coming and the earth made new. And what about our God? Every Sabbath we are reminded that God is just like Christ, our Creator, for Christ is God. Is there any information Satan would rather we not have than this? No surprise, then, that Satan would seek to confuse the meaning of the Sabbath day. I very much like Moffat's rendering of that Exodus 20:12 text, next on the list. I gave them my Sabbath to mark the tie between me and them, to teach them that it is I, the Eternal, who sets them apart. Most of the world has broken that tie. The last message of God to the world is the restoration of the tie. It's a message of love and faith. It's not legalism. If you don't keep that day, I'll kill you. Rather, whenever we preach Christ as our Creator, our Savior, and the one who's coming again, whenever we preach that God is like his Son, we are preaching the message of the seventh day. As you know, when we come to the 66th book, at the very end, the world is described as being divided into two sides. Revelation 12 speaks of the war up in heaven. Revelation 13 speaks of Satan's final campaign and that the whole world will be worshiping him, except the few described in Revelation 14. And look how they're described in 14:12. This calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints who obey God's commandments and remain faithful to Jesus. In that day, the intelligent, wholehearted observance of the seventh-day Sabbath will represent this very faithfulness and loyalty to Jesus. There will be a group who still worship Jesus as their Creator and their God. You notice the Sabbath is not about us. It's about God. I like to think that's why we put that in our name, Seventh-day Adventist. We didn't put it in there to say something good about us, but to say that we'd taken a position about our God. I believe a real Seventh-day Adventist is a Christian who accepts and believes all that the Sabbath has to say about our God. I wish it always meant that. Well, someday God will have to recreate our world and give it to his trusting saints. Look at the last few verses. You know, the world has to be first purified by fire. And Peter says in 3:10, the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. That would be no place to live. And so there will be recreation, Revelation 21:1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. And Isaiah adds in 65:17, behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth. How do you think God will create our world the next time? You know he could do it in an instant, as he could have in the beginning, at creation week. But patient teacher that he is it possible he might do it in days 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 again? I mean, just to say something to saints who have some questions about that simple Genesis account, I can see him doing it and smiling the whole week. But there's one difference about it when the earth is recreated. Will there be need to create an Adam and an Eve? Not this time, just to open the pearly gates and welcome his children home. And Isaiah describes How in the new earth we will be delighted to meet and worship our God. Isaiah 66:23. Month by month at the new moon, week by week on the Sabbath, all mankind shall come to bow down before me, says the Lord. If on the first Sabbath in the new earth, God should say, children, would you like to join with me in celebrating? I'd like to keep this first Sabbath as the most special one we ever had. Would you say, oh no, there we go back under the law again. Why would you need to put an arbitrary test of our obedience upon us? I mean, haven't we proved that we can be trusted? I thought that Christ was the end of the law. We're not under the law, but under grace. How could you talk about the Sabbath still? Would you say that to God? Think of all there'd be to remember. Can you imagine the first 24-hour Sabbath in the new earth? What a celebration. And if at the end of that first happy Sabbath, God should say, I've enjoyed this so much, I'd like to do this every week from here on, would you say, well, one is surely enough. Do we have to do it again and again? I think God might say, by the way, how did you get in here if you don't enjoy this kind of thing? No, Isaiah says, it will be our delight to meet and celebrate with God. So you see, is Sabbath keeping arbitrary legalism? It can be. And it was on that sad Friday, 1900 years ago. But as God designed it, it's supposed to be a monument to freedom. It's supposed to remind us of the evidence, that infinitely costly evidence, that God is not the kind of person his enemies have made him out to be. He is not arbitrary, exacting, vengeful, unforgiving, and severe. He gave us the Sabbath to remind us of that everlasting truth. And it so happens this is Friday evening, the beginning of yet another seventh-day Sabbath. May our thoughts this day be of freedom and peace and love and trust, but most of all, about our God.
As I've listened to what you've said thus far, you've laid a great deal of emphasis on the fact that you don't see the Sabbath as arbitrary, something imposed as a kind of test to see whether you'll just buckle down and obey. And you've certainly given a great deal of meaning, but I've heard people raise this question. All of that may be true, and I can see that it's true, but isn't the seventh day of the fourth commandment, why couldn't it be another day? Does it really matter? Does it have to be the seventh day? What would you say to that? You know, a person might say, look at the Ten Commandments and say, well, now here are nine of them that if you really love God and you love your fellow human beings, why, that's the way you're going to act. That's the way love acts. But as far as a seventh day, a particular day,
yeah, a lot depends
isn't that
on
arbitrary?
The meaning of the word arbitrary. Arbitrariness suggests there is no reason. That God just, because he wanted to, just to show his authority, said, we'll do it this day. I would say if it really were arbitrary, it could be any day. But it's the seventh day because it is so loaded with reasons. Do you ever try on margarine? It doesn't matter when we celebrate our anniversary. This year, why don't we have it some other day?
No.
I don't think she'd take it.
She thinks that the 5th of June is important.
The only day. It makes sense. Yeah. But then the Bible adds meaning after meaning and reason after reason for the seventh day, which makes it less and less arbitrary. It seems to me that no other of God's commands is associated with so many meanings. It is the least arbitrary of them all. What bothers me most about considering it as arbitrary is the thought that if it is arbitrary, the only reason why we keep it is to prove that we are God's good people. We're the only ones who obey. Whereas I understand the purpose of the Sabbath is to say something about him. But those who keep the Sabbath as meeting an arbitrary requirement are simply saying to the world, look, there aren't many in the world who are good, but we keep the seventh day. Mm. The seventh day is not to say something about us. It's to say something about God. So it actually is an important difference.
So the meaning inherent in the seventh day makes that seventh
because
very
he chose to create the world the way he
in
did.
In that way.
Yes. Now, he did make that decision, but I think to do it slowly is not arbitrary. The universe was watching. The charges were to be met. And God, in his own good time, in that very dramatic way, unfolded his plans for our world. And every day we're saying more of the truth about him and the falsity of Satan's charges. That was a dramatic week.
Just a incidental thing here, but maybe someone might be asking this. You've spoken about the fourth commandment.
That's right.
In some thinking and list of commandments, isn't this commandment about the Sabbath the third commandment? How did that happen?
Yeah, I remember once my father wrote to me and said, I've just had a letter from a Lutheran reader of the Signs of the Times about an article on the fourth commandment in the magazine. And the Lutheran reader said, that's the third, isn't it? Well, that's true. Our Roman Catholic friends number the commandments so that the Sabbath commandment is number three. Now, it doesn't mean they're leaving any out. They just divide number 10 into 9 and 10. Strictly speaking, the Ten Commandments read the same in all versions of the Bible. No one has tampered with the Decalogue, not at all. Now, in some catechisms, maybe, or Bible study lessons based on the Bible, where the Ten Commandments are abbreviated, then they may read a little differently. But the Decalogue has not been tampered with. Reads the same everywhere. Of course, there's nothing inspired about Numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, and 10. Who said the Sabbath was the fourth?
Well,
it's called the Sabbath commandment.
All right.
Yes.
But now, isn't the in some listings, isn't one of the commandments about graven images left out?
Well, in the catechism.
In the catechism.
Yeah,
not in the Bible.
Not in the Bible. That's
very
the
important
thing.
Point.
In the Bible, it's not
they're all there.
That's right.
Good. In whatever catechism. Bible, whatever translation.
That's right. You know, tonight I've used two excellent Roman Catholic translations. They're superb.
I noticed that.
They're really superb.
I can hear one of our friends asking, as I have been asked before, in the light of all this, do I have to keep the Sabbath to be saved? If I don't keep the Sabbath, am I going to be lost?
That reflects on our discussion earlier of what sin is. And if you think of sin as just breaking the rules, then one might follow that line of thought. If I break that rule, I'll be lost. It all depends whether there's the distrust and the rebelliousness involved in the failure to keep the Sabbath. I think rather it's the Sabbath was made for us to be of great benefit. If I don't observe it, I lose. If I don't take my medicine, I lose. God offers it to us. There are some who have never heard of it. I don't know if the thief on the cross ever kept one.
Didn't have much of a chance.
No.
Perhaps.
So, in the legal model, if you violate that rule as any other, then you're out, because sin is the breaking of the rules. Sin is the internal distrust and rebelliousness and unwillingness to listen.
So the meaning that God has in the Sabbath for us, it makes it very important whether I say, well, I don't want to be involved with that, just as you were illustrating as you concluded that presentation. But now, Graham,
if as you address yourself to the gift that God has given us, and it inspires a hostility within you, a rebelliousness within you, an unwillingness to listen, that would be the serious thing.
We're back where the problem began.
Exactly. Yeah.
Someone has asked this question. Wasn't the Sabbath, though, in spite of all that has been said, wasn't the Sabbath, in Colossians, the second chapter, doesn't Paul say that the Sabbath has been nailed to the cross? And in the light of that, that no one should judge you regarding what you eat or drink or religious festivals or even a Sabbath day. What about that Colossians 2?
That's so significant. It's worth several hours. How to do it in a moment or two. I think the first thing to do there is to note what was nailed to the cross. The King James says the handwriting of ordinances. And that's taken to be the law. Actually, that word handwriting, I'll pronounce it to show you, I know what's there, chirographon. Chair is hand and graphon is handwriting. That's a very technical term for an agreement, for a bond. It's the sentence that stood against us that was nailed to the cross. But to suggest that the Sabbath was nailed to the cross suggests that the Sabbath was against us, because it says that when this handwriting was nailed to the cross, it is what was contrary to us, against us. He took it out of the way because it was bad. Now, nowhere in the Bible is the Sabbath pictured as against us, contrary to us. It was given to help us. Here Jesus says the Sabbath was made for you, and in a moment I'm going to nail it to the cross because it's been against you. He says it's for you. So they've been nailing the wrong thing to the cross. Rather, when he died, he took care of the sin problem. He took care of the sentence, or whatever word you want to use there. Therefore, let no one judge you in these legal matters. And I think when he says, don't let anyone judge you with respect to the Sabbath either, he's saying, you're right, don't you go around condemning people who disagree with you on the Sabbath. See, sometimes we say, that's ceremonial Sabbath. Don't criticize people when they disagree on the ceremonial. But when they disagree with you on the seventh day, you can go and condemn them all you want to. You can't condemn anybody for anything. That's not our business. Same way in Romans 14, Paul says, one man esteems all days alike. Another man esteems one day above another. And I'm about to come and imprison some of you who don't agree with me. No, he said, let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. And who are you to criticize another? I include the seventh-day Sabbath in that. We are in no position ever to criticize or condemn anybody else who disagrees over this matter of the Sabbath. Paul says, we shall each give account of ourselves to God. So going back to Colossians, something that was against us was nailed to the cross. And once we understand how God has handled the sin, distrust, rebellion problem, then we don't go around condemning other people. But in my own heart, I'm very much persuaded that the Sabbath is for me. I wouldn't want to waste it. I hope I can make it look good to other people so they won't waste it. And we present it as a gift, not an obligation.
But Graham, some of our friends of other denominations, other backgrounds, have raised the question about Sabbath keeping being legalistic. Mm-hmm. When you set out and you're concerned about sundown and the time and when is the Sabbath over and what is appropriate to do on the Sabbath, aren't you back into a kind of worrying about and a kind of bondage mm-hmm. where you're so careful about these things? Isn't that legalism?
Yeah, the word legalism needs to be defined, and I'm thinking maybe the next two Fridays we might have a chance to talk about that. To me, the essence of legalism is preoccupation with one's legal standing with God. And so many of these people who think Sabbath keepers are legalistic are themselves utterly concerned with their legal standing with God and thank God that His Son came and paid the penalty so that they could be in good legal standing. So you see, if you have the legal model, you're a legalist. If you have the other model, you're saying, God, I don't want to miss a thing you've given me. And God says, well, among other things, I give you the Sabbath. It was made for you. You say, what for? Well, read the Bible through and read some of the things we looked at tonight. And you say, God, I need that. I really do. And so we keep the Sabbath as a blessing.
It makes so much difference whether a person is keeping the Sabbath as something that's required
exactly.
to be fulfilled or whether it's a celebration with God of,
yes.
of the glorious things that the Sabbath stands for.
Yeah. And it's supposed to be all about freedom. If a person in the middle of church tomorrow morning while you're preaching does not feel free, maybe he should get up and walk out and take a breath of fresh air and decide whether he wants to come back in or not. Nobody should be sitting here because he has to. Everybody should be sitting here because he feels so good about it feels free.
We may have some
hope you won't lose your audience.
We may have some boys and girls walk out tomorrow to hear that message, or maybe some fathers and mothers.
Well, now, when it comes to the little children now, you see, that does come into next week, God's emergency measures. You can't expect little children to understand these things. Like, they won't brush their teeth because it's good to brush their teeth. They'll brush their teeth because Mommy says so. And don't upset Mommy. She might take measures. And so our little children may not gladly follow us to church. You want to preserve their freedom and teach them responsibility, but when it gets to be time to go, you say, Billy, we're leaving, and you're coming too. So you may have children sitting in the pews under some duress, but you hope they'll sit there long enough to hear the pastor tell them that God values nothing higher than their freedom, and they'll feel good about it.
Well, not only the pastor to tell them, but the parents to help show them.
Oh, that's the most important of all, actually.
Important to do that.
Yeah, that's the most important.
When we talk about the seventh day, we're talking about a long period of time, millenniums.
Oh, yeah.
And the question has been asked, how do you know what day is the seventh day?
Has it been lost?
Could we be mistaken?
Yeah. Well, one thing's sure, nothing has meant more to the devout Jew than the week and the seventh day. And he could look back certainly to when the manna fell, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and double on Friday, and none on Saturday. He knew that was the seventh day by God's direction. And no devout Jew has lost the weekly Sabbath since that time. I would say that's not debatable. We still know.
Jesus didn't seem to be confused when he was here either.
Yes. Sure. Wouldn't Paul have researched it, kind of man he was?
And even for that matter, the idea of Sunday as a day of the resurrection would even confirm, wouldn't it?
Again.
The same consistency of the weekly cycle.
Yeah, that's no serious question at all, I believe.
Now, the Sabbath command, the fourth commandment, talks about thou shalt not do any work, thou and thy manservant, and so forth. Is the Sabbath a day to just sit in a rocking chair in total idleness? What is the meaning of this, thou shalt not do any work?
Do any work. It almost seems hazardous that God would say, in it thou shalt not do any work, and I'm not going to tell you what work is. I take that as a compliment. He says, look, the day is yours. I've suggested its many meanings. If you don't want to keep it, I can't make you keep it. Because it's merely to sit there and do nothing all day under duress is not keeping it. It's supposed to be a delight. And so God leaves it up to us to decide what work is. But many devout people through the years, as you know, have consulted their theologians to determine what work is. And there's a very large volume I have which describes Sabbath work. And in this book, it's called the Mishnah. It says there are 40 kinds of work save one, 39 kinds, and each of the 39 is broken down into tiny details. How far may you walk on the Sabbath? May you carry a pencil on the Sabbath? How many letters can you write on the Sabbath? I don't mean epistles, I mean letters in the alphabet, all spelled out. The beauty of it is you always know whether you're keeping it or not. Actually, those rules leave you with such a fear that you've broken the Sabbath that Jesus said, you place burdens on people that are heavy to bear. I just said, it's your day, in it you shall not do any work. Remember me. So it is left up to us, and I like that.
So then how would one take that statement in terms of the work to earn their livelihood, that kind of thing? How would you understand that?
Well, I think that's in the verse in Isaiah, not doing your own business. And not working for gain. You see, that's in there.
That reminds me of something we were talking about earlier. I've been told that Dear Abby, a couple of weeks ago, in her column in the LA Times, was responding to a girl who wrote saying that she was going to marry a Seventh-day Adventist. And she wondered what that might mean. And Abby suggested that perhaps she ought to talk with the man's pastor and find out. But then another person wrote in and said, aha, I know about Seventh-day Adventists, and if you marry a Seventh-day Adventist, there are a whole lot of things you won't be able to do. Among these, this person went on to list several of these, and then they suggested that you and your husband, as far as the Sabbath, would never on the Sabbath have any kind of marital relationships.
Yeah, I read that. That was number seven, appropriately, on the list.
And the idea was that Isaiah 58 says that you shouldn't do anything that's your own pleasure on the Sabbath. God wanting us to be unhappy on the Sabbath?
Well, the day my middle daughter read that, she phoned me up and said, when you're down in West Covina tonight for Book by Book, stop by the house. I want to write a letter to Dear Abby. So I did a little research on the meaning of the verse, and I brought that along in the back of my Bible. You know, if you look at a good translation of Isaiah 58:13, it really reads, if you restrain your foot on the Sabbath from doing your business on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath delightful and Yahweh's holy day honorable, if you honor it by refraining from business, from pursuing gain, and from excessive talk, interestingly enough, then you will delight in Yahweh, and I'll make you ride upon the heights of the earth. That translation is in the Anchor Bible. There's no more scholarly translation ever. And by the way, that's by John Mackenzie, S.J. You know, the Anchor Bible is jointly produced by Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. But in other versions, I wrote down quite a few, and they all agree that the word pleasure is better translated business, that on Sabbath you can enjoy yourself all you like, but you don't do your own business on that day. You don't pursue your own interests on that day. It even says, if you value my holy day and honor it by not traveling, working, or talking idly on that day. And on this talking idly, the Jerusalem Bible says, abstaining from travel, from doing business, and from gossip. In the Septuagint it says, and from malicious talk.
When you said too much talk, I thought he was talking about Sabbath sermons. But
why I looked that up with care.
Oh, I'm glad.
It's that you will not gossip or engage in malicious talk, whether in pew or pulpit. But the point there is, at the very first, it says, if you call the Sabbath a delight, we're supposed to enjoy the day, but we'll not pursue our own business and our own worldly gain on the day. And then it makes good sense, doesn't it?
Well, now, here's a command that you should call the Sabbath a delight. How can you command something like that?
Well, that's what shows me that it can't be arbitrary. God says, if you really enjoy it, and I'm telling you, you have to. Now, we know from experience you can't do that. When your girls were growing up, I don't know how they felt about spinach or other vegetables. I mean, did you ever say to one of your girls, now look, don't make any more faces. I want you to eat your spinach. Yes, Daddy. Yeah, but I want you to enjoy it. Yes, Daddy. I want you to tell me how delicious it is. Daddy, I'd be fibbing if I did and breaking one of the other commandments. There's no way you can order somebody to enjoy anything. Now, this is what I like. The things that God desires the most. Love, you can't command it. Trust, you can't command it. The enjoyment of the Sabbath, you can't command it.
It's an invitation.
It's an invitation. We either do it or we don't. And if we really observe the day, we do it in the highest sense of freedom, and it is truly a delight.
One of our friends has written this question, Graham, that takes us just a bit away from the subject of the Sabbath, but still, I think, tied into it. The larger view, this person writes, seems very intricate, very subtle, and needing of a lot of study. Does this imply that a simpler view is still necessary for the masses of people who do not have the time or the knowledge to understand the larger view? Now, another card has come in similar. Let me read this. What is the truth about God? I feel it must be simple, and yet it seems so complicated, almost too complicated to encompass. Please help me understand. How would you respond to those questions?
Those are very fair questions. I think that the number one characteristic of the larger view is its simplicity, and that it's not complicated. However, it might require a good deal of study. The more one studies, the less complicated it becomes. I don't think there's any substitute for taking time for study.
So maybe the plea for simplicity is perhaps a temptation to flee from the hard work of thinking.
Yeah, there's no shortcut to this. But what I like is that when you apply the very best scholarship you can muster, I mean, maybe you know the biblical languages and you know all about textual criticism and the history of religions, everything you possibly can. You have all the tools for biblical research. Then if you do a thorough job on the 66, you come up with this view about our God. And all he asks of us is trust. But he doesn't ask us to trust him as a stranger, nor to trust mere claims, but demonstration. I don't think anything could be simpler than that. But I see validity to the question. Paul on Mars Hill delivered himself of a magnificent address. He quoted the philosophers, he quoted the poets, he used long words. In fact, he used the longest word in the Greek New Testament. To the Athenians, he said, oh, you are Deicidaimonus Terus, that's all one word. Then he won a few, but he got to thinking, I'll never preach like that again, magnificent as it was. And in 1 Corinthians, he says, I will never preach again in long words, making things so philosophical and complicated. This one thing I'll do from here on, I will preach the message about Christ and him crucified. So Paul, with his scholarship, eventually focused in on the all-important thing. But when you preach Christ and him crucified, you're preaching the larger view, the one who died for angels as well as men. So the focus led him to the larger view. But he was quite a scholar. I believe the thief on the cross knew enough to be saved. But I wouldn't want to settle for that. I'd like to learn what Paul did. And as long as life shall last, I'm going to investigate. But if my discourse has become more complicated, I'm moving in the wrong direction. So I like the implication here. It ought to be clear. It ought to be simple. But there are no shortcuts to that.
A question came in last week that really touched my heart. This person wrote, how are we who have been raised as Seventh-day Adventist Christians and have been taught to fear God and his judgments to change to a love relationship? When you asked last Friday night, would you be comfortable if the Father walked in, I hesitated to answer, and then I said, I hope so. I'm afraid. How do I dispel this fear?
Oh, I know the one who'd love to hear that question would be God himself. You know, if you'd look at God and say, God, I hesitate to tell you this, but I'm scared. And he'd say, I appreciate that. Wonder what he'd do. Would he say, I think maybe I better not talk to you any longer, you're so scared. I'll send for my son, you know. Well, in practicality, I think the solution is to become convinced in Scripture that the one who came is fully God. People aren't afraid of Jesus. But to realize that the one who is with us is no less than God. And that's what the Sabbath reminds us of. That gentle Jesus, who is afraid of him? He is the Almighty Creator. And then if we could just come to the place where we truly accept what we call the testimony of Jesus. The ultimate testimony of Jesus is, you want to know what my Father is like? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. We find it hard to believe that. So I think we need to read it over and over and come to the place where we really are convinced. You want to know what God is like? Look at Christ, for Christ is God. And as we think of it, number one, it seems incredible, so it takes a little time. And number two, the enemy is opposed to our knowing this, so he will throw up every roadblock he can to keep us from believing this incredible truth.
Now, next Friday night, you're going to talk about God's emergency measures. Right. That will be important in helping us to understand some things that have raised questions.
Because these measures can be misunderstood as supporting Satan's charges, when I think his use of the measures speaks very well of him.
You're going to talk about some of the risks that God has
That's
run
right.
in the things that he has done. So next Friday night,
God's emergency measures.
7 o'clock here at the University Church.
Right.